Blow the horn. Go.
Everything that we do every day, we want to be a champ.
Get your mind right and let's go. Do the little things. Win every day.
It's the sole place they play football.
Everything with an attitude.
Alabama, you listen.
Keith fumbled and Alabama has recovered.
I told you what they were going to do.
Touchdown, Alabama.
It's 13 national championships.
Roll Tide!
I don't give a shit who we're playing.
Nothing they can play against. And make his ass quit. That's our framework. That's our MO with the G.
Daniel Moore, get your canvas ready.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. So, Saturday's contest against Georgia Southern must have been the most annoying record-setting day in history, right?
It was pretty annoying. I'm very glad that Coach Saban gave Trent the opportunity to break the record. And I think a lot of people out there didn't know who Georgia Southern was, but they definitely came to play. And you and I knew with them running the option 90% of the time that, you know, it was going to be a very frustrating day for the defense.
Yeah, I think we kind of called it, right? The option, as you mentioned, we made a point to point out that, hey, this is Georgia Southern and not Georgia State. And, you know, it was like they were gnats. I never was really concerned that we were going to lose the game. They were just a pesky, frustrating team. And my hat's off to them for the way they played.
They did play very tough. You know, I guess we can, whenever we flip to the defensive side, we can touch on a couple more things there. But I guess kind of starting with the offense, we did have them outmanned, you know, on the defensive front. They were probably giving up 40, 50 pounds. And I think Steen and Warmack was happy to see that because they both had a good day. We didn't seem to do a lot of the traps and all the misdirection blocks that frustrated me against LSU. I like the fact that McElwain said, you know, we've got an advantage up front. Let's just let these boys plow forward. And the offensive line seemed like they took advantage of that.
Yeah, we really did. I think this was an underrated offensive performance. I mean, we held the ball for over 32 minutes. We had 460 some odd total yards, 272 rushing yards, 7 of 10 on third downs, no sacks, no punts. Our best offensive lineman out of the game. You know, it was kind of a ho-hum performance, but we put up 45 against a game opponent, and the offensive numbers, you know, were generally pretty good.
I thought they were pretty good, and it was nice to see that we didn't even try to play Barrett. It was nice to see that, you know, McCullough got some more snaps. It was nice to see that Steen got some more work. It was nice to see McCarron have a good day. I think it was really important for him to bounce back, and he seemed comfortable in the pocket. He stepped up a couple times. He kind of extended the play a couple times, and I thought he had a pretty good day.
Yeah, I think he did too. And harkening back to something that you've said on the show before, you know, McCarron was 14 of 19, and so he was right in that sweet spot for a quarterback to be successful, and not just a quarterback, for teams to be successful in the SEC. You run the ball and you throw the ball about 20 times. And so he was right there, 14 of 19, 3 touchdowns, 74% completion percentage. And, you know, for some of the grief that he gets, this was his 5th game this season where he's completed over 70% of his passes. So I'd say, you know, we talked last week about him maybe hitting a plateau. I'm not going to say he's necessarily off the plateau, but he has progressed well and played well throughout this season, I think.
I think it was very important for him to have this kind of game before Auburn next week. If he would have, you know, had a couple sacks or thrown some picks or made some poor decisions, I think that could have really affected his psyche. And so being still a very young quarterback, I think that bodes well for, you know, for Auburn next week. What did you think about, I just want to point out a couple plays. First of all, I want to point out the crossing pattern. I almost wish I could have the footage that the team does and be able to see all 22 players at the same time and slow-mo the play. Because I'd love to know what we do in the action to make that crossing pattern route wide open. But he hit Mays one time for about 23 yards, and it just seems like teams cannot cover that play this year.
I think you set up, and if not perfectly answered your question, you at least, you know, you kind of alluded to the answer. you'd have to look at the coach's tape, the full 22, and exactly see what the action is, you know, that's pulling the safeties in or pulling the corners off the route. You know, conceptually, we know that Trent's always a threat, and so that probably pulls in the safeties. There's probably a little play action that some of those passes are coming off of. I would venture to say that some of the routes and some of the actions and some of the formations would differ. The design of the play and kind of sitting, you know, 50 rows up in the stands, the plays look very similar, but I think, you know, to really break it down, the coaches 22, we see that the action is pretty unique.
That's probably a good point. There was one other play I wanted to touch on just because I don't like all the traps and the pulling and the reach blocks, because that doesn't seem to be our guy's strength. But I noticed one other play, Norwood had to play a lot. And we can touch on the other players here in a minute, but there was a play where McCarron was in the shotgun and Trent Richardson was to his right and Kevin Norwood was to his left. And then when the ball was snapped, Kevin Norwood, you know, moved forward and went and picked up one of the linebackers who they had left uncovered. And almost like a fullback would do a lead block, and it allowed Trent to just try to find his hole in the middle there. And he went for about 12 yards. Now, granted, it didn't have to be Norwood, but that was kind of pretty neat because they don't expect Norwood to go pick up somebody. But I just thought it was a neat little formation, another way to try to get Trent in space.
I agree. Another way of getting Trent in space, and a kind of a head scratcher, right, where we have the, you know, not another running back, but we have a wide receiver, frankly, who does not see a lot of time that he's in there in the backfield. So kind of gives you a head scratcher. Not to say that, you know, I'm not going to assume that we're going to do some funky things out of that, but, you know, it does put something on film that you kind of have to, you know, cock your head and look at sideways.
Hey, what'd you think about Brandon Gibson? Obviously, you know, you talk about the offense and how many points we put up against a team that, you know, has won six national titles, granted Division II, and yes, I'm always going to call it Division II, but, you know, with the Hanks not being in there and DeAndre White not being in there, Brandon Gibson and Norwood had to step up, and senior day, man, I think Brandon Gibson had a hell of a ball game.
It was good to see him have that good day. You mentioned some of the other performers being out. You know, Kenny Bell didn't even catch a pass, I don't believe. So, and Amaze still nursing some injury. To see Brandon Gibson step in and contribute, that seems to be the guy that he is, that he can just, you know, sort of spur of the moment. He can go in there, catch a couple balls, get you a first down, and contribute. But it was good to see him, especially, like you said, on senior day, to participate in the game in that way.
It just set up well. I guess the other thing that was good for his confidence, right, because we talked about he's being such a workmanlike effort in his career, it was just neat that when we needed him because of depth problems, it wasn't against an LSU, which could have been a tough matchup for a Brandon Gibson. It was nice it was against an undersized, you know, secondary of Georgia Southern.
Right.
What else jumped out at you on offense as far as on that side of the ball?
Well, I like Smelly's two touchdown passes, and I know certainly on one of them, and I think on both of them, he was a check down. I don't think he was the primary receiver, and so that bodes well, kind of linking back to the McCarron discussion, that he had a good outing going into the Auburn game. And so if indeed those were check downs, then they are more valuable touchdowns than if that had been the design play, just in terms of his working his progression and then finding a receiver to pitch the ball to. I will say, though, that he attempted a pass to a tight end and nearly got picked off. You know, each of the last 2 weeks, you know, we think maybe he's been baited into throwing a pass to the tight end in the flat. And I think Georgia Southern was maybe trying to bait him into that as well. He threw the ball, and it went incomplete. But that DB was just a shade away from getting that ball, and he would have returned it for a pick six had he gotten it. So
they were watching some tape of that.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we kind of try not to throw to the tight end in the flat. I don't mind the tight end being the outlet because, like I said, I think Smelly got two touchdowns that way. But where the tight end is not – moving, but he's a stationary target in the flat, and that DB is just a few yards off of him, we need to stay away from that.
I don't know why we even go there, because both Williams, surprisingly, and Smelly has shown an ability to run a go or just to do a hook in the middle. I don't know why we keep going out there. It's like we're just being stubborn or something.
We need to watch out for that. And then just another thing that I was a little concerned with was, You know, we had five penalties against these guys. DJ Fluker, I mean, he's dominating at times, but he makes you want to pull your hair out at times too. I think he had a couple of penalties. You know, invariably, when I looked at, you know, someone getting beat or someone not maintaining their block, and not just Saturday, but, you know, the last several games, it just seems that Fluker's name bubbles up to the top more than anyone else, even with all the grief that we've given Steen and the fact that McCullough started the season on the bench. You know, Fluker seems to be a guy that we struggle with.
Well, I do want to point out that, you know, those false start penalties are just in general. You know, there was probably some paint being peeled in the locker room because, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, we had those five penalties in the first half. We didn't have a single penalty in the second half. It was nice to see that those mental errors went away magically in the second half.
Yeah, I think across the board we played a little bit better in the second half. And, you know, I think that speaks to the focus. I hate that we have to turn it on and turn it off, but we can. And I think this is another example, maybe not as dramatic as some of the other games. You know, Vanderbilt's a good example where the turning it on and off was a little more dramatic than it was in this game. But I think we played much tougher and mentally focused and aware in the second half of this game.
Let's solve this Eddie Lacy mystery once and for all. What do you think gives with this turf toe? I'm just really curious, you know, because he ran really well. There was one play where they did a play action to him, and he was so smart to keep the play going and go out in the flats and got an easy 12, 13 yards. And granted, he's not showing the same moves maybe he did with his spin moves at the beginning of the year, but he still looks 85, 90%, and I'm not at practice, and I'm not seeing him not having to go, but I keep thinking, you know, I just wonder what the formula is here, because Joker cannot practice all week, comes in for five or six plays, looks like a beast for his five or six plays, clock in my 50, 60 yards, call it a day, take my lunch pail home. Oh, Trent, you got to carry the rock 30 times now because I only went five or six plays, and I'll see you again next Saturday.
Well, you know, you have to look at the nature of a turf toe injury. It's an excruciatingly painful injury. And
but do you think it only allows him five or six carries is what I'm curious
about. Well, I think what we're doing is we're limiting the workload. You know, 99 out of 100% of the time, it doesn't require surgery. It just takes time. And so you can heal it to the point where it starts to feel better, it starts to recover, but you can step off the curb wrong and set yourself back, you know, weeks of recovery time. And so we're bringing him along, but, you know, we're not going to bring him into a game and give him 12 or 15 carries, you know, which would otherwise be his normal workload. We're not going to do that at the risk of then him having to regress back to, you know, sort of stage one of the injury and then be, you know, not available. So I don't like Trent getting 30 carries necessarily. He's a prototypical workhorse, and so he can do that. And then that gives us the opportunity to rest Lacy. I think Lacy is, you know, sort of coming back to full strength. And, you know, coaches even talked, you know, before where he kind of has to rein him in, and because Eddie wants to be on the field and he wants to play. And so that speaks to him being recovered enough that he feels that he can contribute and he feels healthy. And when he's out there the last couple of weeks, you know, if you take his performance the last 3 weeks and you compare that to the 3 weeks prior to that, he has looked very dominant. He has definitely gone into beast mode a couple of times, and he did that Saturday. I just think we're managing his carries at this stage. You know, we think that, you know, as we stand now, we think we have the Auburn game, and then we have some time off for the bowl game. So I wouldn't be surprised if he gets a few more carries Saturday. You know, maybe he does crack double digits, but I think we're just giving him time. That's the only way that this injury really is going to heal. And so we just don't want to set him back in his recovery.
All right. So then explain Trent to me, because we know Saban's not about individual awards. I know he gets stronger as the game goes on. I get all that. But, you know, we don't want to take the chance of him getting banged up. Everybody's nicked up at this point in the year. So just to be critical for a second, because I enjoy doing that when the opportunity presents itself, why does a Trent get 32 carries and needs to get 180 yards And Jostin Fowler gets 8 carries, but those are pretty much the last 8 plays for the offense in the game when there's about 5 minutes left on the clock. I mean, the score was already 38-21. Why the hell not bring Trent out earlier? It makes no sense to me. Jostin has plenty of tread on those tires.
I completely agree with, you know, Jostin having the tread on the tires and definitely being able to come in and perform well. The carries and the snaps that he got, you know, he certainly did. I think that, you know,
was he getting him stats, man? Was he getting him stats for the race?
Yeah, that's kind of the long, I was going to kind of build up to that. I think, you know, we'd have to read, you know, sort of the memoirs at the end of his career to kind of get some, you know, kind of get the straight dope on this. And he'd never admitted in a press conference and he'd kind of, you know, chew you out of the room for suggesting it. But I would dare say that, you know, Trent finished with a 175, 3 touchdowns, 2 carries, 2 of them rushing.
And oh, by the way, he broke the single season record that doesn't look bad going across the newswire, too.
Exactly. So I think when you kind of look at all those together, you know, we had somebody kind of suggest to us that Saban's, you know, really has a favoritism towards his starters. And I think I kind of balked at it at the time. But you can see it in instances like this where he has. And if you go back and look at the duration of the wholeness of the season, there's been times where, you know, Trent's carried the ball to the 12. And, you know, when we bring Trent in to get the touchdown. So
that's a good point, because a couple weeks ago against Mississippi State, Trent came out after doing all the dirty work in the fourth quarter and Lacy got the touchdown around the end.
It's almost funny where you can almost call it like, okay, it's time to bring Trent in to score the touchdown. And that's not to say that Eddie can't score it, but we want that sort of that tick mark in Richardson's category, you know, and Lacy will get his turn. I think there's something to that. He'll get his turn. But hey, what better recruiting tool is there for the high profile running backs in the country than potentially Saban to be able to say, well, all I know is, you know, 2 of the last 3 Heisman Trophy winners were running backs at Alabama.
No, that's true. And I guess we need to touch on this for a quick second, because we talked about this on other podcasts, but I think it's, let's just say that that plays out and Trent's fortunate to be able to win the Heisman, which I'm very hopeful that he can do that. Man, it just goes back to, you know, Trent Richardson does not shy away from competition, and I'm coming to Alabama. I could have gone to Florida. I could have been the next Emmett Smith at Florida, or let me just say I could have been the featured guy at Florida. I could have started as a true freshman, just like Crowell's doing at Georgia. I could have had all the fame, and he chose to come to Alabama and sit back and learn under Ingram. And man, that's just so awesome for that kid that here I am, the number one running back in the nation, and I can go anywhere, and I went to the University of Alabama. I just think that's awesome.
Yeah, I think we can certainly be proud of that. I think that, you know, one thing when you think about, you know, the top-notch running backs, they may not be inclined to go to a spread, and so I think that probably did work against Florida a little bit, but to come in to Alabama, not to shy away from the competition, you know, with Mark Ingram and others that were on the roster, I think that speaks highly of him. And, you know, I look forward to getting to see him play, you know, for the Tide for at least 2 more games, I guess.
Yeah, that and, might be it.
And then I guess we'll fight over who gets to draft him in our fantasy leagues.
Hey, what was the deal with DeAndre White? Kind of enlighten me a little bit. What was the deal with that?
We know nothing more than a 1-game suspension. He and Nick Gentry were both disqualified from this game, a 1-game suspension, so don't know really any more than that, just an undisclosed violation of team rules.
Okay, but there was no speculation. I mean, we don't need to put that out there, but obviously there's been some conjecture as to what this was about. But are you surprised it's just a 1-game suspension?
Well, I'm assuming it's a 1-game suspension. In fact, I think for Gentry it's been stated that it's 1 game. I guess I'm assuming for DeAndre it is. We know that, and we've spent some time talking about him being in the doghouse.
That's what I was just about to say, and man. So, he's playing with fire a little bit.
Well, we'll have to see if he suits up and plays Saturday.
Anything else on offense, or you want to flip it to defense?
No, take us to defense.
All right, well, defense, you know, obviously we talked about they were going to be running this option 90% of the time. And, you know, for anybody that just didn't know this, I think it's important to mention the lack of depth that we had at the nose guard position. Our defense that we run, you know, inevitably is really more of a, I guess you would say more of a 3-4-5 defense, and or 3-3-5, excuse me. And so that nose guard is key. And, you know, Josh Chapman wasn't able to go. Jesse Williams really didn't go that much. And so we had to get a lot of time from Quentin Dial and people like Jeffrey Pagan, true freshman. And I think Dial played pretty well as the game went on. You're a JUCO. You haven't really played a ton. And now in a week's time, you got to learn how to key on that dive fullback and that quarterback. And, man, the worst thing you can have against a team running an option like this is lack of depth up the middle.
Every week there's one word that, to me, sort of encapsulates how our defense, you know, played. And this week I just wrote harassed. Our defense was harassed. You know, the triple option's a nightmare. There's a reason that teams struggle with when they play Army or they play Navy, you know, or even Oregon, you know, during the season, because the style of play is just so difficult to prepare for. And so you take a team like Georgia Southern who practices and practices and practices, and this style of triple option is in their DNA, and it's so counter to how we play ball, basically, you know, see ball, attack. And here, you know, you may see the ball and you may see it go the other way, but you need to stay at home. And so you just need to trust that the guy next to me or the guy two positions down is going to make the play, because as soon as I get out of position, then there's a pitch or there's some reverse option, and I really look bad when they run it up my hole. So I think we were really, you know, harassed, the defense was. And it's almost inexplicable, you know, how a team like this against the top-rated defense was able to have success. It kind of parallels in my mind, you know, Tim Tebow having success in the NFL. How is he able to have the success that he is in the NFL, you know, completes two wobbly passes a ball game and they're winning? That's not supposed to happen that way, but it is, because he's playing a style of play that no one sees. That's kind of what happened to us. Our defense was harassed. And then to, you know, not to be too long-winded, but to go back to what you said, depleted on the DL, you know, Chapman had a knee, Gentry was suspended, Jesse Williams was sick, and he's been battling some injury as well. You know, Brandon Ivory played a whole lot on Saturday.
And he doesn't play normally very often.
And he has not played a lot this season. And he actually missed most of practice because he had a knee injury. So he was in the game playing when he had not really practiced a lot. And then Undra Billingsley, who's kind of our emergency nose guard, ended up playing quite a bit at the position as well. So, you know, we were really depleted on the DL, you know, probably not representative of how we would have played these guys had we been full strength, and probably not representative of how we'll look this week when we have some of these guys coming back.
I guess it's also important to mention that, you know, as far as the defense goes, you know, what's really frustrating is they played pretty well. It was really those two plays. And what's, you know, in all the years I've watched football, I can never remember a time when a team throws one ball and it's a touchdown on the stat sheet.
Yeah, you know, it takes me back, and I'm going to date myself a little bit. It takes me back to the 96 season when Bill Curry brought Kentucky back to Tuscaloosa. And they were playing an option and an option style. We shut them down and shut them down. And we ended up beating them, I think, 35-7, I think, was the final. But they scored one lone touchdown. We had shut down their option, shut down their option. There had been so many three and outs where we were just closing them down. And then eventually it just sucked in the defense and they threw it right over our head. And it was a relatively short pass and a long run. And it was just excruciating to see that happen. And you know that it happened because our defense kind of sucked in. And I don't know the stat line from that game, you know, other than just that play so vividly. But I know that they didn't pass very much in that ball game. And, you know, the Eagles here certainly didn't pass much either, but they sure connected on one.
Well, it was interesting. Saban talked about it after the game, that, you know, that Dre had just been, you know, like four times in a row, they had come to around his end on the option and had had a few yards off of it. And, you know, I love it when Saban starts talking all of his, you know, technical defensive schemes. And he was talking about it was a corner rollout, a corner rollover. and that Barron was supposed to take the, you know, the center field position, and he fell down, and Dre was supposed to run with his guy on the clear out, and he bit on the option, and he only bit for a minute, and that's all it took with Barron having fallen down in the back there. There was nobody to pick him up, and yeah. So that just goes to show you, you know, four times in a row, they come right at Dre, and then great play call the very next time, they pick their spots, and it worked out.
Yeah, they kind of lull you to sleep, right, because you know, Dre's not going to sprint downfield to have to come back and maybe support the run. And so by that fourth time, and then they kind of get a little bonus when that also is the play that, you know, probably wouldn't have gone for a touchdown had Dre sucked in, but Barron still, you
had
know,
not
still been there
yet.
Over the top. But with he fallen, and so both of those things kind of happen at once. There you go, it's touchdown.
On that big run that they had, which was frustrating, right, because we had just gone up 17-0 and I don't think that we had been lulled to sleep, you know, or what I mean by that is that, you know, we were playing pretty well. It was early in the second quarter, like we were up 17-0, and we bring in some backups with the depth issue. And when you go back and look at that fullback dive that they scored on, he really didn't go between the center and the guard. He really went kind of off tackle, and Jeffrey Pagan was in the game on that play, that true freshman. And he was supposed to take the quarterback or the fullback, and he took neither. And he was in the backfield, and he just kind of whiffed and missed. And they got a hat on a hat on everybody else. And he was the only guy that had a chance to stop him, and he just missed. And it was funny then that about the 20-30-yard line, the tailback was actually, you know, both of those guys had a lot of speed, right? And the tailback got out there in front of them. And just to give Lester grief a little bit, because that tailback had to be all of 5'7", he literally pushed Lester down at about the 30-yard line, and that allowed that guy to go ahead and score the, you know, get that last 30 yards. But those were the only two chances they had between Lester and Pagan.
Yeah, and Hightower chased that play down from behind too, and he ended up shoving the escort blocker down.
But how did he shove Lester down, man? How did that happen?
Well, you know, you get somebody running off balance, I don't know. But the fact that Hightower was all the way downfield and out of frustration, you know, he shoved the blocker down. You know, I thought that was a hustle play from Hightower, even though, you know, unfortunately, you know, he wasn't able to make the tackle.
It was. And I just wanted to point out the Pagan thing for the listeners, because here he is a true freshman. He's played very little. And he comes in, we're up 17-0, and, you know, just – misses his assignment. You know, he hasn't been getting as much work as the other guys.
Yeah, and that just goes to show how quickly you can get beat in a play like that. And it also just goes to show you, you know, with the depleted, you know, bodies on the DL that, you know, we have to bring in someone like that, and it happens. And fortunately, he was out of position, and, you know, and they blocked it very well, and that led to a long run.
Hey, what do you think about them going for it on 4th and 5 at our 8-yard line in the fourth quarter? They showed some big ones there trying to get a touchdown and, you know, obviously act the way a team should that was, you know, down by 17 at that point. But what do you think about them not just trying to put 3 more points on the board?
Well, you know, at that point, 3 more is not going to do a whole lot for you. And, you know, he's sending a message to his team that he does have faith in him and he's going to compete. And, you know, we're going to put it all on the table. No woulda, coulda, shoulda, we're going to line up. And if we ever think we have a chance to win this game, this is the kind of play we need to convert on. You know, men, I'm going to give you a chance for it.
Anything else on defense before we talk about special teams?
Yeah, I want to bring up 2 things. We continue to play a lot of base, which, again, I'm not mad at us playing base. The only thing that I'm a little concerned with or a little frustrated with is the fact that that leaves Mosley on the bench. And so we're playing a personnel grouping and formations off of that, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. But to continue to do it with, you know, we're leaving our best linebacker on the bench, or one of our best linebackers on the bench. And I get a little frustrated that at this point in the season, I get that we have a lot of multiple packages. I get that we have a lot of sub packages that require Mosley. And so we maybe want to limit how much he plays in base when he's going to get a lot of snaps doing the other sub packages. But when we're not doing the other sub packages, then we need to find a way to get him on the field.
I thought you were supposed to call Kirby Smart on this, man.
Well, I just got booked up doing other things.
I mean, you know, as you look at the stat sheet, right, it's not all about the stats, but we've definitely given Jarrell Harris his share of grief. He definitely has been more of a support role these past few weeks as his reps have gone up. But to your point, I think it's fair to say CJ is one of the best linebackers. And when you look at this stat sheet, you know whose name's not on here? Jarrell Harris. You got a team that ran the ball all but five plays in the game. And you've got a Brandon Ivory who got three assists. And Jarrell Harris doesn't even have a single assist.
You know, and look, I won't even go the route of knocking Jarrell, because let's say he's playing serviceable, and then the stat line, you know, to your point, may tell you something different. I can have a serviceable linebacker in, or I can have one of the best linebackers on the team in, and by extension, one of our best defensive players I can have in the game. And so at some point, look, our plan for this game is to play a lot of just base 3-4. We're not going to go a whole lot of nickel or dime unless it's, you know, third and long, fourth and long passing situations. And so we're going to see a lot more of just the true base. Then I'll look for opportunities to, you know, have a handful of plays from base that I can run with Mosley at that position instead of Jarrell. And heck, you do that to spell Jarrell, if nothing else. But then you also get the benefit of having one of your best defenders on the field rather than on the bench.
Just to go a little further with that, Jarrell, you know, I would love to see a role for him. If you're spelling him, he could be part of your blitz package on some of your blitz packages. I'd love to have him try to wreak havoc on the corner. They really haven't done that much with him that I recall. But if you can try to wreak havoc with an Alex Watkins, why can't you try to wreak havoc with a Jarrell Harris?
I agree with that, you know, and we've sent him a few times, but not a lot. But when he is on the field, sometimes he just looks lost. And I just can't help but think, man, we've got one of the best linebackers potential. You know, you can't take anything away from Hightower and Upshaw. So it's hard to be, you know, it's hard to go too crazy with the praise of Mosley, because, you know, he probably does fit in somewhere between those.
But, man, I started to say real quick as a footnote, Hightower and Upshaw are two of five finalists for the Butkus Award. So exactly, how crazy is that?
Well, exactly, right? And so it's hard, you know, you need to be careful in saying Mosley's, you know, as good as those guys are. But I think the skill set that he has is different.
He brings more than Jarrell does. Let's just call it for what it is.
Yeah, I guess that's the bottom line. And if I can have three sort of all-conference caliber players on the field, when I know that he otherwise isn't going to play, then I'm going to figure out a way to get him on the field. I guess that's the bottom line on that.
Well, hopefully the formation against Auburn, we'll see more of him, I think, this week.
I think we will. I feel very confident that we will this week. One other just point I want to bring up on defense is Will Lowry, you know, kind of breaking his knee. And so, you know, Lowry's one of those glue guys. You know, he's, when we go to nickel sometime, he's the nickel. When we go to dime, you know,
he's always in there for the dime. Yeah,
he's always in for the dime. And so you think of all the talent we have and all the high wattage recruits that we have in the secondary, you know, walk on Will Lowry is a guy that we can't keep off the field. The last couple of years, you know, who's he? He's the guy out there making plays, picking the ball off, you know, in coverage, critical times in the ball game. He's contributing. Has been contributed on special teams as well. He's just one of those guys. We can't chase him off the field, and then he goes and has a knee injury and is gone for the year. That's something that we kind of need to put a footnote in, because, you know, who then does come in?
On really the dime, for sure.
Certainly for the dime. And so who is it that comes in to play the dime snaps that otherwise could not beat out Will Lowry? That's what I'm interested to see. And when we're bringing in the dime, you know, we're talking third and long. We're talking critical pass situations, very important times in a ball game. And so that's something that I'll be very interested in, who we bring in, how they play, and how the defense as a whole kind of reacts to that rotation.
We've talked before about how, you know, Barron, I mean, Will Lowry is one of the reasons that Barron has been able to play up next to a CJ Mosley in the dime. Because we've been able to put Lowry back there with Lester. And so it does make you wonder, because I think Barron is way more comfortable up close to the line of scrimmage.
Oh, yeah.
And gosh, I hope they don't have to rotate him back.
Well, you hope it becomes a situation, and you call this on the offensive line, where if Barrett, you know, a couple of weeks ago, if Barrett couldn't go, then Steen's coming back in and we're moving McCullough to tackle. You know, by the loss of one player, we weaken two positions. You wonder if potentially in a dime you have that type of situation. If Lowry goes out, Barron has to change what he does, and then we bring someone in to kind of backfill Barron. I hope that we don't shift it that way. And in the secondary, I don't think we will, but that just goes to, it's going to be darn interesting to see how we accommodate for that.
Who do you think, real quick, we put back there? Surely we don't do a Vinny. Do you think we do a Jerick Williams? Who do you think we see back there?
Well, you know, some of what I've read has talked to it potentially being Vinny. I'm surprised that I'm not seeing more talk on it potentially being Phelan or...
Or Ha-Ha, right?
Or Ha-Ha. You know, Phelan's a corner. I get that. But, you know, you can do different things when you have five DBs. But is it a Clinton Dix? Is it...
What about Phelan for Daquan Menzie? I'd be comfortable floating Menzie back there.
You know, potentially, you could potentially do that. You know, Menzie brings a lot to that star position. You know, you really want to be careful with that. But, you know, there's a number of guys, and I think that it's going to be, like I said, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I think Vinny is in the mix. I think Phelan's in the mix. I think of John Fulton. Now, he's a true corner, but I think he's someone that if we wanted to mix it up and go with a dime that with a strong coverage element.
Yeah, because you need a center fielder, right? That's
yeah.
Really what you're going for back there.
Yep. So.
Okay. Anything else on defense?
No, I think that kind of wraps it for me on defense. Why don't you talk us through special teams?
Well, your talk of John Fulton, I got to pick on him for a second because, as Coach Saban said, the only blemish in the second half from his point of view was that kickoff return. And, you know, Hardy Buck, a very valuable walk-on player, just, you know, got – they put a hat on a hat, and Hardy Buck kind of collapsed his lane a little bit there and got out of position. But John Fulton is one of your safeties. He's your safety valve, and he's supposed to stay 10 yards off the play, and he overran it, and he just underestimated the speed of the return guy. And had Fulton played where he was supposed to, they would have, you know, he would have tackled him at midfield. He wouldn't have got a touchdown there.
And then so, you know, on one hand, you think, well, then that's correctable because you can just drill into the guy, you know, to play in position. At the same time, it's frustrating as hell that, you know, we're going to give up a kickoff return, you know, what is it, 95 yards. And then, you know, for good measure, let's go ahead and miss another field goal. And then so.
And we gave up a big kickoff return last week.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, damn, we got the athletes. What's the deal here?
Yeah, it's just frustrating. Those are two, you know, some of the most frustrating elements of within special teams because they're not freak. You know, like we blocked a field goal attempt and returned it, you know, for a touchdown. Okay.
That was a great physical play by Dante, by the way.
It was. It was.
That for a second.
No, it was. I'm not discounting that.
Yeah.
But it's a freak play.
Yep.
That's a very freaky thing. And so they can be pissed off that that happened, but it's like, come on. In 100 years, that's not going to happen again. A kickoff return is very routine. You know, covering a kick is a very routine thing. You know, shanking a field goal, that just shouldn't happen. You know, you go out and you kick and you kick and you kick and you make them in practice. And so those are things that are just so frustrating because it's just fundamental execution that we should be seeing in both of those phases. And we just continue to struggle.
And that's our chink in the armor. Let's call it what it is. I mean, you know, we found that out the hard way against LSU. And if this team is going to be able to be fortunate to try to close the deal, we didn't have this problem in 2009. That is definitely a challenge for us. And it really puts a lot of pressure on the offense because the offense really says, I got to at least get the ball inside the 30, inside the 25. I mean, what a difference it makes for an offense when they can say, well, gosh, I got stopped at the 35-yard line, but, you know, I got a kicker that can drill it from 52 yards. I've talked for the past few weeks about how we get cutesy when we get around the 30-yard line, and hell, maybe McElwain thinks he's got to get cutesy because he's like, I got to get this ball in close or we're going to walk away with here with no points.
Exactly, exactly. If you had a kicker that you felt that, okay, I've got points. Now I'm playing with house money. Let's do something as opposed to, you know, just like you said, I'm about to walk away here with nothing. I've got to dial up something crazy to, you know, convert this into points. And it really changes how you, you know, the confidence of the team, the execution, and then what you're going to call. I think it really can.
They start pressing, right?
You start pressing the players and the coaches, and it can back you in a corner in terms of how you're going to call plays. And so I think that's what happened there. Anything else on special teams?
Well, just the kickoffs are still not worth a darn. I mean, how many times did we kick it to the 7, 8, 9, 10-yard line?
Oh, you know, here's a great stat for you. I think we did have two kicks into the end zone. I know we had one. And so one kick into the end zone.
We had one touchback.
And so that's where I'm going. So the one touchback that we had in this game was the third touchback of the season, and it came on the 63rd kickoff of the season.
Oh, gosh.
And then the number actually, you know, percentage-wise went downhill from there because we didn't kick anything else in the end zone.
Three out of 63
touchbacks.
That's abysmal. That is abysmal. Who's your mini game ball on offense?
My mini game ball on offense I'm giving to Brad Smellie. Two touchdowns. You know, I think we were both kind of surprised earlier to, you know, confirm earlier this season to confirm that, you know, he's a senior and had his first touchdown of his career this season. And so to go out on top as a senior with two, I think that's impressive. And I think they were both check downs, which I think is impressive. So I'm giving my mini game ball to Brad Smellie.
That's a good call. I kind of alluded to this earlier. As much as I want to give it to Trent just because of his big day and his big record-breaking day, I've got to give it to Brandon Gibson. You know, Brandon Gibson, man, you're a heck of a blocker downfield. You do great on special teams. You know, you finished tied with Smellie for four catches, you know, right at 50 yards. And I don't think you've ever had four catches in a ball game. So my ball's got to go to Gibson.
Fantastic. Who are you going on defense?
You know, on defense, can you guess who this is going to be, man?
I'm going to let you just bring it.
I've got to give this to Quentin Dial. You know, as much as I hate that we had these depth issues, I was really wanting Quentin Dial to really be a cog, and he hasn't had to be this year depth-wise. Him and the likes of Undra Billingsley have really not had to be there because Jesse Williams has really stole the show. And Quentin Dial had to get a lot of snaps. I wish I knew how many snaps he had, but he finished with 8 tackles and 1 tackle for loss. You know, I do look at the stat sheet, and I do think that's a very telling thing on the defensive side of the ball. And for him to finish with 8 tackles, you know, we need that experience, and we need him having those reps, and that can only help us for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I think that's a good pick. Quentin Dial certainly played well, and, you know, I think he's got a lot of ball left in him the rest of the season and next season, and I think that he's going to be a key contributor the rest of his career. I'm giving my mini game ball on defense to Mark Barron. You know, he had 8 tackles as well, and he just seemed to be a plugger.
And his was solo, though. That's even bigger. His was 8 solos.
Yep, that's exactly right. And that kind of speaks to, you know, I'm calling him a plugger in this game. He seemed to maintain his gap responsibility, which – if everyone is maintaining their gap responsibilities, playing this type of, you know, triple option, there are going to be a lot of solo tackles because everyone else is sort of battening down their hatches. And so when you come through my gap, it's my responsibility to block you. And Barron, especially in the second half, seemed to really be minding his responsibility and making some very physical tackles. He laid the wood a couple of times. I'm giving my nod to Barron, another senior.
I think that's a good call. Probably not a mini game ball, but that's okay. We'll let you go with that one.
Well, I'm going to pull my Tommy, and I'm going to kind of bend the rules here on the mini game ball as well. I went out of my way to give both of my game balls to seniors, and I do that really in honor of Senior Day and the senior class who went into Saturday with all-time record 45 wins. Exited Saturday, all-time record 46 wins. We have an opportunity for 2 more to be added to that total. But as they stand right now at 46, they are the winningest senior class in the history of the program.
That is an impressive stat, and it shows you how good that class of 2008 really was. And, you know, we got a lot of signature guys from that class that, you know, that went pro earlier, or maybe they could have even broke that record with a few more wins.
Yeah, I think we're going to look back, you know, years from now, and we're going to kind of look back on this era with Mark and with Julio and with Trent and with Dante and with Darius and with Hightower and with Upshaw and all of these players. And we're going to think, wow, we only won one, maybe two national titles.
No, that's true. And let's face it, right? If they're able to have more than one in their win column, that'll be pretty impressive, to say the least. What do you think about this war that we've got coming up on Saturday? What do you think, first of all, about the extra day? It's nice to not have this game on Friday like we had the last 2 years.
Yeah, I do like having the extra day. I do think that the team needs to get their head, you know, kind of screwed on, focusing about this game. I think they stayed up late last week celebrating Iowa State's win over Oklahoma State. I think that led to some of the first struggles in the first quarter, sort of over-celebrating that. I think we need eyes on the prize right here against Auburn. I think that that should not be a problem. They've got, you know, posters and reminders in the weight room, you know, for a full year, never again. And so I think never again, do they want to hear never again?
Right.
I think
they're kind of tired of that.
Yeah, I think they're going to come out very, very businesslike. I think we outclass them. I don't think necessarily we dominate them. I think we're going to see some Kyle Frazier, newsflash here, I guess. We're going to see Kyle Frazier run some option.
They're going to try to get some Cam Newton love again, aren't they?
Well, I wonder if at some point they don't stretch themselves too thin and try to do too many things. And I think our defense is certainly up for the challenge. I think our offense is up for the challenge. And I'm looking at a very methodical, a very businesslike 24-10 game.
I'm going to tell you that I hope it's not that close. Their offense obviously doesn't do anything to scare us. You know, they're ranked a paltry 93 out of 120 teams. They're only averaging, you know, 25 points a game. And their defense has given up over 400 yards. And even special teams is nothing to write home about. I'd love to see a repeat of 2008, but I don't think we're going to see the 36-0 when we show Tuberville the door. I do think this is going to be the statement revenge game, and I'd really like to see something like a 31-3 or 31-7. I really hope that we beat them by at least 20 points.
I would love to. You know, don't get me wrong. I'm calling a 14-point, you know, spread. I would love to double that, but I'm giving a little bit of nod to playing in their house, and they do have some talent. And then, of course, they game plan for this game a little bit all season. They kind of take away from some of their other prep and other performances to focus on this game. They're a beat Bama program. That's really all they care about. And
it's because of the little brother, man. That's what they got to do.
And it kind of shows through in this game in that they do, you know, they are able to perform well against us. I'll say I'm the first one that surprised that they have 7 wins on the board. I thought for sure they'd have a losing season this year. And they do seem to be improving, which I'm not a fan of Chizik personally, but that's a hallmark of good coaching when you have a team that is improving through the course of the season. So I'm going to give a little bit of nod to those factors. And like I said, I'm calling the 24-10. I'd love that to be, you know, a little more on our side, a little less on their side, though.
Just before we wrap up, you know, we probably should have led the podcast with this. Christmas kind of came early to the Alabama football program this past weekend, didn't it?
It's funny that you use that term because I've been calling it an Alabama Christmas. You know, special thanks to Iowa State, special thanks to USC, special thanks to Baylor. It was almost set them up, Joe, knock them down, because, you know, the Friday night, you know, was perfect. And I was kind of kidding with someone. I said, well, those Iowa State uniforms looking awful like USC's uniforms. And so maybe the magic will carry over. And about the time that game started winding down, you know, they were showing on the crawl that Baylor was leading Oklahoma. And I thought, well, for good measure, let's knock out one more one-loss team. And I still think Oklahoma will beat Oklahoma State, give them 2 losses. Alabama's in the catbird seat because we're going to play Auburn. LSU has to play Arkansas.
So LSU's got to do the dirty work.
Well, exactly. And so for winning the game against us and being ranked number one, you know, almost since, I guess, the start of the season, all of a sudden as we sit here, now they have the harder road, which is – you never would have imagined that that would be the case. But now they have to play Arkansas on a short week because they actually play that game on Friday. And then they have to play a real emerging Georgia team. I think that, you know, we have to, obviously we need to take care of our business. That goes without saying. But you stacked up, you know, Georgia, Auburn, and Arkansas. Auburn's the lesser of those three. LSU has to play both of the other two. So I think we're in a very interesting position where we have to win. But outside of, you know, once we take care of business, we're essentially assured a seat at the national title table. And LSU still has some work to do.
Well, and you would have to think that we're rooting for LSU against Arkansas.
Yes.
Because we want to keep distancing that margin, and we just want to kind of push Arkansas down now, right?
Well, what we want is the status quo to sustain itself.
Right, and that's the best way for that to happen.
Well, the two teams on top, one and two, to continue to win.
Right.
And so a week ago, had we been talking about the status quo sustaining itself, it would be LSU and Oklahoma State. Well, that apple cart was upset, and so now we're sitting here, and I don't want anything to upset the apple cart that has us in the one and two.
No, that's true. And it was very interesting to see, I guess, a couple quick things on that that was just hilarious to me was the up-tempo of Oregon, you know, that we've got to just run, you know, 10 more plays than our opponent. And, you know, why not call a timeout and allow yourself to have a few more plays to get in a chance to do something at the end? So I thought it was hilarious that they just kept running plays and just let the clock run down. And then I thought it was very interesting that even though they had been very successful, that Oklahoma was going to go for two and take a chance there at the end of that game. It just shows you how much both of those coaches knew. They both knew how important a win was last Saturday.
Oh, absolutely. You know, both teams to have a loss, but knowing that they're still in the discussion, if they're able to win. And then just, you know, see it for both of them just literally within a few minutes to see it both just slip away. Never seen anything more beautiful in my life.
Well, the Oregon thing was the hilarious one, right? Because they make such a big deal of we're better conditioned athletes and we run all these plays and, you know, dumbass coach just forgot to call a timeout. I know, he didn't forget, but he should have called a timeout.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't want to dissect that game too much,
but,
you know, I was questioning their you know, Chip Kelly not calling timeouts there. But I tell you this, though, because they are a fast strike team and they are an up-tempo team. And when USC could have done just about anything with the ball, they could have run backwards 10 yards and just, you know, kick the ball, you know, out of bounds on fourth down and give the ball, you know, back on possession because the time they would have been able to burn so much time. They literally could have done anything in the football landscape except for turn it over, and that's exactly what they did when they dropped that. And I thought, you know what, they're going to lose this game
because
of that. Because, you know, playing at Oregon, the momentum was shifting back to Oregon at that stage of the game.
We thought bad things were about to happen.
I really thought that they were going to lose that game, and it just turned out that they didn't. So that was a phenomenal game to get to watch and enjoy. And I'm glad for the implications it has on our Tide. So,
oh, sure. Absolutely.
That's certainly exciting. Well, I think we're all certainly looking forward to the – I hesitate to call it the Iron Bowl because it's not in Birmingham anymore, but we're certainly looking forward to the matchup with Auburn this weekend. I think if the Tide can take care of business, we'll get to do some podcasts leading up to a national title, which I think that's certainly exciting. But until then – this has been another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Thanks for listening. Be sure to drop us an email at alabamafootballpodcast@gmail.com to be added to our mailing list and follow us on Twitter at Alabama Football Podcast. Roll Tide.
Blow the horn. Let's go.
Everything that we do every day, we want to be a champion.
Get your mind right and let's go. Do the little things. Win every day.
It's the someplace they play football.
Everything with an attitude.
All right.